This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, Kate Forrester with you for the Country Hour this Monday afternoon. Good to be with you for another week right across Western Australia, wherever you might be listening from today. Coming up on the show, it's been a decade on from the Esperance bushfires that claimed four lives back in 2015. So after the headlines, or just before the headlines, I should say, and the weather today, you're going to hear from locals from down that way who say not enough has been done to ensure the community stays safe if another event like that one or similar was to happen again. So you'll hear from farmers and bush firefighters who are pushing for an increase in funding for fire mitigation and some other areas they want to see more progress in. And then after the rainfall today, I'm going to take you to the farming town of Nibing in the Great Southern, where over the weekend they were able to put together a kids' cricket team for the first time in 35 years. So as you can imagine, that would have been a really exciting and huge day for the community. So you'll hear all about that and also who may have won. Hopefully they got up. 12:06 here on the Country Hour right across Western Australia. To start with today, a Victorian crop assessor who spent the past week touring farms across the Midwest and Wheatbelt believes the recent storm that swept through key grain-growing regions has indeed caused substantial damage. Marty Colbert is a hail agronomist and has been out checking paddocks while also keeping a really close eye on the radar, staying on top of what might be coming in the next couple of days in terms of weather. Marty, to start with today, what's the extent of the damage from that storm a few weeks ago?
Over here in the west, I've been assessing an area, we'll just roughly say from York at Westonia down to Bruce Rock. There's a few outstanding around Beverley, so it's been a pretty busy week so far.
And what's the extent of the damage that you've been seeing?
It's really ranged. I think it was a long set-up event. The way it came through, it had time to settle into fingers of destruction. So there's a real variance of whether the hail came through a particular area or not. And when it has, it's also had a variable impact depending on the severity of the hail amount, but also the crop type and the maturity of the crop. So it's been, well, this morning I was in a paddock of canola, beautiful crop actually, well in excess of 2 tonne potential. And there was zero impact at one end of it. It was only a 60-hectare paddock. At the other end of it, it was 90%. So it is all over the place. But that is the nature of hail.
And whereabouts was that canola paddock this morning?
That was south of Cunderdin. That's a definite streak of impact there, although I'm up in downtown Cunderdin as we speak. There wasn't so much here. And I would suggest that event went straight over the town but just didn't drop itself. It's unloaded when it got down to there. But the other day I was out at Westonia and nearly at Bullfinch, and the magnitude of that event was probably greater. So it's sort of how that storm mass has set itself up as it's moved in from those northern areas. It's had time to develop fingers, and if you were fortunate, it just didn't hit you, but it has been pretty widespread within the zone I just described.
And are there crop types that you've been looking at that are more affected than others?
Definitely canola. It was more mature at the time of the impact. Perhaps certain varieties of canola were more mature, and that's standard for how canola goes with its varieties. But there's also been significant impact in barley, which was also close to being ready.
Marty, for growers who are insured, what do you think the outcome financially is going to be for them once you finish your job?
Well, generally, and this doesn't matter whether I'm in Western Australia or Queensland, most crops are underinsured. People look at their farm budgets and decide how much money they can apportion to their insurance products. They'll only cover the cost of production. And when they have an insurance payout, it's not level pegging with where they would have been, but it offsets some of the loss. So it's something, but it's not everything. What will happen is an assessor will go through and value the extent of the impact as a percentage term, and then the farmer will return to it and harvest the rest of it. So it's not a matter of walking away from it. Very rarely is there an event which we call a total constructive loss, which is where the whole crop's gone. The farmer will return to those crops. Perhaps he or she will decide to use their time on some crops that haven't been damaged and return to that hailed one later, because there are a few, it can be actually be a little bit more difficult to harvest a hailed crop because it's not as regular the way it'll feed in across the front. No one really wins with the hail, whether they're insured or not insured. Just the ones who are insured don't bear as greater impact.
But how do you actually go about determining the level of damage in a paddock? Because what I've heard in the past is it can be quite inconsistent. What one assessor sees as damage, the other might not. So how do you ensure that consistency, Marty?
That's a great question. So the knack of it, or it's not a trick, but the knack of it is to be proficient in what you do, but also to get access to as great a part of the paddock as you can. Fortunately, in Western Australia, you have fire breaks around most paddocks, so it's not too bad to have a look at a greater number of areas. And then within that area, you try and pick a typical part of the plant stand, and then it's a matter of ascertaining, and it doesn't matter which crop it is. An easy way to look at it is loss is anything that won't make it into the header box. So it could be lost grain positions, lost heads, lost pods, but specifically in canola and perhaps in lupins, even a pod that's still there but has a crack in it, it probably won't be there before the harvester gets to it, or might even be lost as the reel passes by. More recent development is we also have the ability to review yield map data. I spend a lot of time doing that. And there might be a 200-hectare canola paddock. No one's ever going to make it to the middle of that to do an assessment. And so if the numbers don't stack up as they should, we can review biomass maps that were satellite-derived and then correlate that with a supplied yield data map, and we can get to the answer that way.
You're listening to The Country Hour this Monday. It is 12 past 12. And at the moment, I'm joined by Marty Colbert. He's a hail assessor who's come over from Victoria, who has been here the past 7 days taking, I guess, a close look at crops hit by that storm a couple of weeks back. And I would love to hear from you on the text line today. Have you been one of those who has unfortunately had to get their crop assessed over the past week or so? And what did you find out? Send me a text on 0448 922 604. Marty, when do you think you're going to be finished assessing?
Well, I'm operating with a group of five other assessors in our consultancy group. We're dealing with in excess of 60 claims. We're well into it. I would suggest by the end of this week, if we don't get too much wet weather, we'll be across all of those.
I mean, you're from Victoria assessing our crops. Why are you here versus, I don't know, someone from WA?
It's not because of my good looks. Anyone will tell you that. I just do lots of hail. My first hail event this year was in August, and I actually haven't stopped. So I was on the Queensland border 2 weeks ago, worked down through New South Wales. There was the Victorian Mallee, a few there. Actually did one on the way to the airport in Adelaide, jumped on, came over here, into it that afternoon. I just sort of follow the storms.
And how does it compare to what you've been seeing over east, this storm event we had? How does the damage compare?
The nature of the storm's a little bit different than what's normal. Even other events I've done over here in Western Australia, in that it's had so much of a east-west, came from the north, but to be spread out so far from the east to the west is a little bit different. The sheer square kilometres involved is a little bit different, whereas the cells that went through northern New South Wales were very tight, very intense, and like certainly took 6 tonne the hectare crops back to zero, but the cells weren't, the systems weren't as big as this one that came through. Also a different range of crops. I spent a lot of time in lentils, and I know the West Australians are now starting to produce lentils, and that is a very different crop to assess. So, yeah, good luck for when we have a hail event in that crop over here.
at the moment, growers are watching the radar very closely for the next few days, I'm sure, with that potential of more wet weather on the way. And soon we're going to be hearing from the Bureau. Angeline Prasad is going to be with us just after the headlines at 12:30 to run us through what that could look like. What have you been hearing from growers about the next couple of days, Marty?
Most of them will make reference to the weather that's coming, and I'd say the general sentiment I'm getting from them is hammer down. Everyone's into it. Flat out, get as much off as you can before it gets here. There's a huge amount of the Western Australian crop now very susceptible to the next event. It would appear that Geraldton to Esperance is in the line of this next event coming through. I can put a positive spin on it. Perhaps it'll just be a few points of rain and that'll be it. But if there's any hard stuff in it, there's just a lot of crop ready to get hit.
When you say, you know, this second event is going to be more susceptible, what do you mean by that?
The event that came through on November the 5th, a lot of the crop was not fully mature, so it was able to withstand a little bit of the impact. Whereas now, and even in this last week, so much of the crop has matured and is ready to go, it takes a lot less hail to have a detrimental effect. And talking to other agronomists, have a look on Twitter or whatever, there's just headers rolling everywhere, hence there's a lot more hectares ready to get hit.
Marty, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for your time on the WA Country Hour today, and good luck for the rest of your trip and the assessments.
Thanks very much, Kate. It was a pleasure.
Marty Colbert is a hail assessor from Victoria over in WA, just at the moment assessing those crops. And I did ask to get your thoughts on the text line today. Have you had your crop assessed over the past week or so, and what did you find out? Do send me a text on 0448 922 604.
Across Western Australia, this is The Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
Past 12 here, and as I said, it's always great to get your thoughts during the hour, so do feel free to text through if you want to say something. It's 0448 922 604. Rio Tinto has pivoted its green steelmaking strategy, pouring more than $35 million into a deal with Australian technology company Calix. Now, the global mining giant plans to construct a green steelmaking demonstration plant here in Western Australia. It's been estimated the processing of ore into iron and steel contributes about 8% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. The 30,000-tonne per year pilot project is slated to be built in Kwinana here in Perth, but with hopes of one day bringing the process up to commercial scale in the Pilbara. Calix CEO Phil Hodgson says it gives them confidence in their technology.
It provides, I guess, a bit of validation that our technology has enormous potential to help decarbonise iron and steel. So, highly important for us.
Can you describe, sort of in layman's terms, the technology behind this partnership? You guys have dubbed it ZESTY. What does that actually mean?
ZESTY is zero emission steel technology. As most people probably are aware, to make iron or steel, they have what's called blast furnaces or electric arc furnaces. We just have a different type of furnace. With our particular furnace, it's like a big steel tube, and you heat that tube externally. You could use fuel to heat it, or you can use electrons to heat it. You know, we're energy agnostic. And what we do is we put the iron ore down the center of the tube. Basically, it's got to be a fairly small particle size. Imagine sort of dust or flour, that sort of particle size. And we just basically drop it down the tube. And as it floats down the tube over 20 to 30 seconds inside the tube, the red hot walls of the tube radiate heat into those particles. And we also introduce hydrogen in the bottom. And as the hydrogen flows up through those particles as they fall down, the hydrogen reacts with the iron ore. It leaves the top basically as steam, and out the bottom is iron. And so iron can then go on to make steel. So rather than big blast furnaces producing, you know, over 1.8 tons of carbon dioxide per ton of iron produced, we can produce iron with zero carbon. So that's the basis of the technology.
Will the demonstration plant be zero emissions? Because even if it's hydrogen powered, it might not necessarily be green hydrogen, right?
Yes, that is a good question. We obviously, at scale, at full scale, the technology has the ability to be zero emissions if it uses renewable electrons. We're locating this facility in Kwinana. Our ability to access renewable electricity there is one of the key considerations that we need to take into account. The key thing we need to do is to demonstrate that the technology works at scale. It will be a full-scale single tube that we build there, and scale up from there is simply multiple tubes. So not every ton of steel or iron that we produce in Kwinana out of this demonstration plant will necessarily be zero emissions per se. The idea is to demonstrate the technology at this scale so that the full-scale commercial units can be.
And obviously so much of our infrastructure here in WA is structured around bulk commodity export. What makes you confident that this project can overcome hurdles where others have failed in terms of processing minerals here in Australia?
Yeah, good question. Certainly, the demonstration facility in Kwinana is not set up to do massive amount of exports. It's going to be producing, you know, it's going to be about a 30,000 ton capacity plant, which is very, very small when you're talking about the scale of the iron ore industry in this country. And so the demonstration facility itself, we're not looking to necessarily export per se. Ultimately, where you make the cheapest electrons, as in the cheapest renewable electrons, might be where green iron making is made in the future. So if we can get access to the cheapest green electrons here in Australia, that's a massive opportunity for us to make green iron in the future. And if we're making green iron here, then rather than just exporting iron ore, then obviously that's a considerable value add to this country.
Are you confident that you'll be able to grasp that opportunity?
In the end, we are the technology provider. The big iron ore players are the ones that need to grasp the opportunity, if you like. Are we confident that they will? Certainly, someone like a Rio working with us on this gives us a lot of confidence that the iron ore industry can be innovative, can be prepared to move downstream in the value chain.
Calix CEO Phil Hodgson speaking with Alistair Bates about the company's $35 million partnership with Rio Tinto to build a green steelmaking pilot plant. 22 past 12. Well, the Esperance community gathered this morning to remember the four lives lost in devastating bushfires 10 years ago. But as Tara de Landgraaf reports, some people believe more needs to be done to prevent a similar disaster.
Four lives, 300,000 hectares of land, 30,000 hectares of crop and thousands of head of stock. The date November 17th, 2015, will forever be etched in the minds of Esperance locals. Three separate blazes, started by lightning 2 days prior, created an inferno like no other. In the years since, there's been two inquiries, one public, one privately funded, and Coroner Sarah Linton made 12 recommendations in the wake of her inquest, a bid to ensure that kind of event never happens again. In 2020, the state government said it would support or support in principle 10 of those recommendations. They included boosting DFES offices in the state's southeast, which currently stands at 5, the installation of a phone repeater tower at Peak Charles, 5 new light tankers for the Esperance region, and an aerial firefighting fleet deployed to regional areas, including Esperance, at the start of harvest. The state government decided not to adopt recommendations to instill a career fire station in the state's southeast, or to allow for the purchase of earth-moving equipment which could be used during mitigation works. Grasspatch farmer Dan Sanderson says while the state government has increased funding for mitigation, it's nowhere near enough.
Things have got a lot better responding to fires than what we went through in 2015. The lack of machinery, aircraft, personnel available when we needed help wasn't there. It was hard to come by. We've got a long history of very good chief bushfire control officers in the Shire of Esperance. We have a really good shire that's, especially since 2015, that have been wanting to work better with brigades and fighting fires and mitigation. So a lot of that has improved, but there's still a fair bit that needs doing.
Mr. Sanderson was one of three farmers who spearheaded a privately funded review into the bushfires, along with David and Linda Campbell. Mr. Sanderson says a decade on, he's no longer angry, but he is still frustrated.
When I started on this review into the fire, I was angry and I was frustrated. I've since learned that it's fine to be frustrated, but it's wrong to be angry. All you do is build a brick wall when you're trying to talk to people. So I've changed a fair bit and I've learned a lot. There's only a limited amount of money. There's not enough money. The ESL is huge. It's about $500 million a year. And there's only a small fraction of that comes to volunteer bushfire brigades. So I was looking at cost-effective solutions. And I've given up on the cost-effective solutions. All I want is effective solutions. And that's probably been the biggest change for me in the last 10 years.
Greg Kernow farms at Cascade. His uncle Kim, or Freddie as he was known, lost his life in the blaze. The coroner found the four deaths on that day arose by way of accident. Greg says it's hard to believe it's been 10 years.
We were particularly strong at the time about not assigning blame. We really just wanted proactive change and improvements for the safety of people, lives and property. There has been some really good improvements and aspects to it, particularly on a local level with the Shire and DFES working well together on a local level. There are aspects that are quite disappointing though and still really haven't been addressed in a meaningful way.
He says a decade on, mitigation is still their number one concern.
I'm not part of the inner sanctum with these sort of things, Tara, but looking from the outside and talking to people, I think it's, from what I can gather, there's a lot of conflict between agencies and organisations, not a lot of organisation, and really, at the end of the day, these things should be left to the local brigades to run. It'll be far more efficient. It will get done properly and safely at a fraction of the cost. And these organisations, I mean, some of them are good at changing their names, but not really doing a hell of a lot else. These organisations, their primary role, in my opinion, would be to facilitate and not to think that they need to do these activities, fire breaks, control burns, etc., etc. I think that's where their focus should lie, personally. Remembering back to the 2015 fires and the several meetings, etc., we had afterwards, one of the comments from one of the chief fire control officers at the time was, there's no 100%ers in firefighting, but mitigation is a 20%er, which is a big one, and I think it's probably one of the biggest ones to ensure safety of lives and property. We've invested significantly in machinery and firefighting apparatuses personally, and pretty much every business in this location does. We had another instance with a young man passing away 2 years ago from almost the exact same sort of incident. These things happen. We're in a high risk area with lots of reserves which are unmanaged, unmaintained. Look, I think the risk is always going to be there, but if this continues, it isn't going to reduce without positive change.
Since the Esperance fires 10 years ago, the state government says it has significantly increased its spending on bushfire mitigation on-ground works. It says $9.5 million has been granted to local governments through the Mitigation Activity Fund Grants Program, with $1.15 million of this spent within the Esperance Shire. Additionally, in the last financial year, DFES said it spent $80,000 on unallocated Crown land and unmanaged reserves within the Esperance Shire, specifically targeting on-ground works. The state government says the emergency management landscape and framework has undergone significant reform since 2015. A rural fire division's been created, written notification procedures are in place for when a fire officially gets handed over, and work has begun on an emergency services exposure draft bill. Dan Sanderson says the bill has been a long time coming, and he hopes rural brigades will get a chance to review it before it's enshrined in law.
Looking through my notes from 2017 when we tabled our review and saying, yes, in the next 2 years, we're going to be looking at these acts and it's going to be done. Here we are 8 years later and it still hasn't happened. And I'm concerned now that it will get rushed through and there will be like 3 months. You can have a look at it in 3 months. It's 3 months is not going to be long enough to look at it. We're going to need to have a look at it, go through it.
Esperance Shire President and volunteer bush firefighter Ron Chambers also hopes the details of the combined act will be revealed soon.
It is taking too long. We need to get that act up so that we know that the act and the regulations that we work at are, again, suitable for today. You know, the acts that we're working on are old acts. There's a lot of things that have changed. There's a lot of stuff that can be improved in them. And, I would really like to see that work done at a much, much faster rate.
DFES says regional brigades will have the opportunity to comment on the exposure draft bill once it's released for public comment. This morning, a remembrance service was held at the Jetty Headland in Esperance, with family members from across the globe travelling to the state's southeast to remember the four lives lost. Mr Chambers says while the fire remains forefront in many community members' minds, going forward, he wants to ensure that communication lines remain open between state and local government as well as rural brigades.
I think the most important thing is that government continues to listen to the volunteers, continues to listen to the guys on the ground. And they tend to do that through the implementation of the working groups that they do for equipment and the interaction between both the department and volunteers.
Both Mr Kernoy and Mr Sanderson say while time has passed and the community is rebuilding, they will stop and reflect today and hold hope that an event of this magnitude never happens again.
Oh, time has definitely helped. There's no doubt about that. It's been tough. The memory doesn't fade, but it gets easier to deal with. And people move on. You have to live your own life. You can't dwell on the past and past actions forever, otherwise you get stuck in them. It's still painful, but it's... yeah, something we reflect on and, yeah, life goes on and we need to make sure that it keeps going on. I'd love to have more to be done, but reality is that governments and bureaucracies sometimes move at a glacial pace. I guess we're lucky that we've had the progress we've had in some ways when you think about it. In other ways, it's very frustrating and it continues to be frustrating, but I'd hope with the right people in place that we continue making progress. That's all you can really ask for.
Cascade farmer Greg Kernow speaking to Tara de Landgraft about those devastating fires that killed four people a decade ago. And a remembrance service to recognise those four lives lost was held this morning in Esperance. I'm told about 150 people were in attendance, including overseas family members of those who died. And Tara de Landgraft, who was at the ceremony, also let me know that the ceremony concluded with a beautiful piece of music recorded by Anna Winther's dad, Sergey. Anna was one of those four lives that were lost during that fire. 28-1 here on the Country Hour, and Jonathan Beale is in the studio with the headlines.
Thanks, Kate. The Asbestos and Dust Diseases Research Institute says the risk of asbestos exposure from recalled coloured sand is low, but that a higher degree of caution should still be exercised. More than 70 schools in the ACT are closed due to asbestos contamination in coloured sand products used in the classroom. The Premier, Roger Cook, has confirmed the sand has been detected in more than 70 schools in WA, but no closures are required. The Institute says the response has been appropriate. The Youth Affairs Council of WA is calling for more investment to address youth homelessness in the state. The council says in the metropolitan area there are 32 crisis beds, while 225 young people are sleeping rough or in temporary accommodation each night. The council says while frontline service organisations would like to help everyone, they don't have the resources to do so. And a Republican member of Congress says there could be some 100 Republicans voting for the release of the Epstein files this week. The US House of Representatives is deciding whether to publish unclassified documents linked to a sex trafficking probe into the late pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. The president, Donald Trump, was a friend of Epstein but says they fell out around 20 years ago. Congressman Thomas Massie says if lawmakers don't vote to release the files, they vote to protect pedophiles. More news, Kate, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Jonathan. 27-1. And between now and the news at 1 o'clock, we will head to Mouchet just to get that total yarding number of cattle at today's sale. But before we get there, it is time to check in with the Bureau of Meteorology now. Angeline Prasad joins me to go through what's happening with the weather around the state. Angeline, on Friday's Country Hour, I was told that there could be some more wet weather on the way this week, especially in key grain-growing areas in the southern part of the state. So let's start there. What's happening in the south?
Good afternoon, Kate. Yes, we have got a deepening trough. Well, it's moved offshore and there's a low pressure system associated with it. It is dragging in moisture slowly from more tropical areas. So today, starting off with today, it's going to be more dry thunderstorms, especially through the far northern parts of the southwest land division, so through the central west. Maybe extending into the far northern parts of the central wheat belts of north of Dalwalanu. So showers and thunderstorms in this area, but mainly on the dry side. It is, because the trough is deepening, we've got this hot, dry, northeasterly winds. So there is elevated fire dangers through the northern parts of the southwest land division. And we do have a fire weather warning out for the Midwest coast. So that's part of the central west. So although we've got some thunderstorms in the landscape, they're not likely to produce much rainfall, and so there is a risk that we could see lightning strikes starting wildfires in the landscape, unfortunately. Now, as we head into tonight and into tomorrow, the moisture over the southwest land division does increase, so tomorrow the showers and thunderstorms become more widespread and spread across much of the southwest land division. Especially the northern parts of tomorrow, northern parts of the southwest land division will certainly moisten up. There will still be a mix of wet and dry thunderstorms tomorrow, but certainly, especially across the northern parts through the central west and the area, especially north of Meriden and north of Perth, potentially could see 5 to 10 millimetres, but especially the area north of Dalwalanu and Jurien Bay could see isolated falls getting up to 10 to 20 millimetres with that risk of getting even very isolated heavier falls reaching 25 millimetres. So the thunderstorms do become quite juicy and start producing a fair bit of moisture. Now, it is going to remain quite convective, so here and there. If you compare it to the weather system 1.5 weeks ago, it was more of a rain bed with embedded thunderstorm activity. This time around, it's slightly different. Starts off as more showers and thunderstorms, so these fall from discrete clouds here and there. So not every location will get the rainfall, but suddenly it's starting to look that way. Now, on Wednesday and Thursday, the trough and low pressure system come ashore, so move across the west coast and move inland, and they do bring in a lot more moisture. So tomorrow, the thunderstorms are likely to stay across the northern parts of the central wheat belt, but there will be a few light showers over the southern parts of the southwest land division, but I'm not expecting much. On Wednesday, the thunderstorms become more widespread right across the not only southwest land division, right across southern WA. And that pattern continues into Thursday and Friday. So we could see several days of thunderstorm activity across the southwest land division starting from Thursday. It does look more of a rain band pattern starting from Wednesday night into Thursday. So when we talk about rain bands, the rainfall is more widespread, so it may cover most areas. So we could be, again, looking on Wednesday and into Thursday, on average 5 to 10 or 10 to 15 millimetres, but there could be isolated falls getting up to the 20 to 30 millimetres in some locations, especially when we see thunderstorms training. Now, severity of these thunderstorms, that's going to be the interesting thing. So we are looking at severe thunderstorms as this trough moves or deepens offshore over the next few days and then eventually moves over land. So in terms of severity, the hazards we are looking at are damaging winds, hail, and also heavy rainfall. Now, not all areas will get these severe thunderstorms. Tomorrow, it's likely to stay over the central west. And then on Wednesday, the area will most likely affect the area of severe thunderstorms could impact the far northern parts of the central wheat belt. And as that trough moves ashore, we could potentially see isolated thunderstorms more over inland parts of the southwest land division. We do see weather contracting out of the southwest land division, but it's unlikely to happen until Saturday.
Certainly got not good news for growers at this time of the year. No. Let's head to the north of the state now, Angeline. What's happening there?
Well, elsewhere, it has been a bit dry, but the the dry thunderstorms that I mentioned will affect the Gascoyne today. There's a fair bit of heat being drawn into the southwest, and these dry thunderstorms do extend into the inland parts of the Pilbara and across the Kimberley and into the northern parts of the interior. We've had a fair bit of dry that's moved in from the south through these locations, so the showers and thunderstorms, I'm not expecting much rainfall with them. They will be generally on the drier side. So we did see some good thunderstorm activity over the Kimberley on Saturday, but since then it has become much more isolated and has dried out. So over the next few days, it's going to be mostly sunny with very isolated showers and thunderstorms, especially across the Kimberley and the Pilbara. Now, the Gascoyne, the Goldfields, the Southern Interior and Eucla is another story, because they are being affected or will be affected by the deepening low pressure system and trough offshore. So the showers and thunderstorms do increase across the Gascoyne and extend into the western parts of the Goldfields tomorrow, and then obviously become more widespread right throughout southern WA on Wednesday and Thursday, and including Friday, before we see a gradual clearance over the weekend.
Sounds like there's a lot going on. Thank you, Angeline. Now, Richard Hudson is making his way into the studio to go over the rainfall figures. Richard, what can you tell me about over the weekend? What happened?
Yeah, so from 9 o'clock in the morning on Friday through to 9 o'clock this morning, it was mainly the Kimberley had rain. So Bedford Downs, 21, Billaluna, 30, Charmy River, 22, Curtin, 19, Debisa, 6, not to be confused with Debisa. You're a Pixies fan, surely, Kate.
Is it bad if I say, sorry, what is that?
Oh, one of the most influential alternative rock bands in the world. I went and saw them whilst I had a week's leave, by the way. But anyway, Derby Main Roads, 8, Diggers Rest, 12, Doongan, 55 mils over 4 days, Drysdale River Station, 25. Your dad's not going to be happy with you, I can tell you. Ellenbrae, 28, Faraway Bay, 27, Flora Valley, 23, Fossil Downs, 18, Gibb River, 15, Gogo Station, 21, Halls Creek, 17, Kachana, 64, Kalumburu, 30, Kilto Station, 44, Kununurra had between 16 and 31 mils across three locations, Lansdowne, 6, Leopold Downs, 14, Lombardina, 17, Margaret River, Rivers Airstrip recorded 27, Marion Downs 30, Moolabulla 19, Mount Amherst 19, Mount Barnett 5, Mount House 24, Mount Krause 11, Mount Winifred 9, Nicholson 80, Old Mornington Homestead 29, Parry Creek Farm 30, Siddons Creek had 86, Sophie Downs 51, Sturt Creek 29, Theda 17, Troughton Island 35, Truscott 32, Wyndham 24, Yampi Sound 16, and Yulumbu 41 mils. Nothing for the Pilbara or the Gascoyne, but in the interior, Warburton recorded 26. Nice little downpour. And nothing recorded in the Goldfields or Eucla districts. Nothing out on the islands. And there wasn't too much in the Southwest Land Division. In the Central West and Lower West, there was nothing at all. And then in the Southwest, a number of places had between 1 and 2 mils, but Northcliffe topped it with 3. And then you've got to go down to the Southern Coastal region, where Albany's Airport and Mount Barker recorded 4 mils and Narracup West recorded 9. Nothing reported in the Central Wheat Belt, but in the Great Southern, Franklin had a tiny bit with 2 mils. We're getting into summer when harvest bans start to come in, and there is one in place at the moment. So due to the risk of fire, the city of Greater Geraldton and Mullawar has a harvest ban in place. So that's been imposed on the harvesting and the use of any equipment that could potentially start a fire. And you just need to be in touch with your shire to get notification as to when that harvest ban actually gets removed. But just about 320 kilometres southeast of Perth is Nyobing. So it's just east of Katanning. It's got Crosby Farms very close to the Nyobing township itself. Scott, you've just heard what Angeline Prasad has mentioned about what's on its way. Are you concerned at all about what you've just heard?
Oh, look, it's, you know, I guess Storm Lotto again. We'll see how it goes. Yeah, like nothing much we can do about it. We'll just get heads down, bum up and carry on as per normal.
How's your season faring?
Yeah, no, quite good. We're a bit over halfway in canola. done a little snippet of some barley to fill in a bit of time before canola was ripe, and I've actually done some lentils as well. So they're ticked off. It's been pretty good so far, so I hope it continues.
Over my years of experience, Scott, when someone says, yeah, not bad, they're sometimes hinting at a record crop. Are you looking like having an absolute perler?
It'll be above average, that's for sure. You know, canola's probably not going to do best ever. Might be a spidgin under. Barley potentially might be up there. But we've only done one paddock, so, yeah, a lot more to go from there. We did a bit of sample of oats. That was pretty good. And wheat, yeah, I don't think wheat will be best ever, but it'll be close. It's going to be overall a good season. Price is a bit lower, but that's life. It'll be functional and quite good, I'd say.
And you've got some sheep as well still. How are your dams faring?
We're lucky here. We've had a reasonable rainfall year. And so dams are generally, if not full, on above three quarters or above. So, yeah, we're going to be okay for that.
Now let's concentrate on the most important topic now, cricket. You had quite a momentous event over the weekend, didn't you? What happened?
Yeah, we had our first junior cricket game in Nibbing for we're thinking 38 years, having a Nibbing team represent themselves in a junior cricket competition, which is, something quite unique, I guess, for that time frame.
Fantastic. Did the kids enjoy it? Was it a good atmosphere?
Yeah. Definitely good atmosphere. There was a great crowd. Plenty of people that didn't actually have children playing turn up as well. So, it was great. Did see two farmers that probably had plenty going on. I don't think they were that bored. I think they just come along thinking it's a great thing and, wanted to support the young kids as they've brought something alive, which is totally not normal in the country these days. Is to bring something back to your community.
You don't hear of that every day, but I hear you were umpiring and you were actually there on the very last day when cricket was played as a junior in Nibbing.
Yeah. No, that'd be correct. I did umpire at square leg for a little bit. So, and I was, around when they had their, last competition game. So, it was great. Can't remember a lot about that. I was only a young fella, some 9 or 10. But, I enjoyed playing cricket and went off and played elsewhere when Nibbing didn't have a team. So, it was great to see that and see my daughter having a game as well on the big Nibbing cricket ground. So that's great.
Did they win?
No, unfortunately. Wasn't a silver lining there, was there? it was a competitive game. Everyone got a bat in both teams, which is good. So I guess that's what we want. Everyone have a bat and everyone have a bowl. And when playing under 13s, it's all about development, isn't it? Both teams enjoyed it, so that's the main thing.
It is, but I hope you gave her a bollocking afterwards. I mean, competitive game is neither here nor there. It's all about winning, Scott. Jeez.
Unfortunately, I think training on Wednesday night, when Coach Allen comes back, he unfortunately had a prior other engagement and couldn't be there. I'm sure he'd give him a bit of a tune-up and, say, come on, kids, we need to improve this. Probably the silver lining there is Alan and his nephews and brother's kids and his kids weren't there. So we've actually got four new injectees into the next team. So that'll help, I guess.
What was the secret to getting cricket back at your local town, at your local ground?
The secret is having someone willing to put their hand up to run it. As in all country sport or all country communities, if someone's willing to put their hand up and say, yep, I'll run it, well, most people will follow along and, get involved. So the kids are keen. The kids are always keen to do everything, but the parents were keen, and that's the key.
So who was the main driver?
Well, you'd have to say Alan and Sarah Hobley. They're the ones that put their hand up to do the legwork at the start. And, then there's a variety of other people come along and fall in line to help out. So, community effort, but, Alan and Sarah, definitely.
Oh, well, fantastic. Nice to hear cricket's back at your home ground. Be interesting to see what happens on Friday in the first test as well, speaking of cricket. But I hope the remainder of the season goes well for you and the other farmers in your area, Scott.
And on the test match, let's hope that we don't get a rain delay personally and we have the opportunity to go to the test match, we're busy harvesting. But in some respects, I wouldn't mind having the opportunity to go. So that could be a silver lining with a bit of precipitation.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for your time with the Country Hour.
No worries. Thanks, Richard.
What a positive and fun story. That was Scott Crosby, who grows grain and runs Merino Sheep very close to Nyvang, which is about 320 kilometres southeast of Perth. And as Scott just mentioned earlier, that those types of events, I guess, and bringing sporting events back like cricket is all about having those people who are keen to put their hand up and really be in the driver's seat. So it's great to hear that Nyvang has those people there. It is 11 to 1 on the Country Hour here today. And in other news, the 10% tariff on Australian beef exports to the United States has been cancelled following a sharp reversal in policy by US President Donald Trump after coming under pressure to lower grocery prices for Americans. Simon Quilty is from Global Agri Trends, and he says Australian sheep meat and goat meat will still incur a 10% tariff. But the beef trade is back to zero, which he believes is a win for Australian beef producers.
I think overall those fundamentals of lack of supply with a herd, you know, at a 63-year low just remain in place. And, you know, I think from an Australian point of view, it's helpful in that I think given how tight supply is, that 10% will be passed back very quickly to Australian livestock producers within the next week or so. Matt, we were always believing prices were going to move higher. This just adds a lot more support to the Australian market. Does it lower prices for the consumer in America? No, it doesn't. I think that continues to move higher as they move into their own rebuild.
How bad is it getting over there for US consumers?
Well, Matt, prices are up, if we look at wholesale prices, by about 22% for the year. And beef definitely sits at this elite premium in the market. I think the latest figures is $7.30 per pound versus pork and chicken, which are half that price at around about $3.15. So there's no doubt, Matt, that the pressure is being felt by the consumer. But extraordinarily, Matt, month in, month out, beef consumption continues to be at these levels, prices rise, and the amount consumed continues to increase.
They just love it.
They just love it. And it's the millennials that we can thank, Matt, because they have learned to cook at home. We've seen, you know, the white tablecloth side of the industry has suffered, never really recovered after COVID. And what we've seen is that the retail sector has truly stepped up and filled that void. And as a result, you know, young people are staying at home and cooking expensive meat at home, which they love.
For our audience, Simon, can you explain this 10% tariff on Aussie beef that has been in place for most of this year until now? What difference, if any, has it made to the trade?
It's made no difference, Matt. In actual fact, within the first 3 days when that was introduced in March, we saw the value of Australian lean beef in America on their domestic market jump by 20 cents a pound. So it was passed forward to the consumer in America immediately. So I guess it just makes sense that the Trump administration now realise that it is the consumer paying for these tariffs. It's not being passed back to the exporter in Australia or anywhere else in the world. And so as a result, I think common sense has prevailed and said we need to remove this if we're going to try and lower that cost to the consumer. Unfortunately, I think it's a drop in the ocean, Matt, and that the consumer in America continues to have to pay higher prices, as we said, because the rebuild is about to begin. So the long and the short of it is the impact in America, I think, will be somewhat small.
So just finally, this tariff news that's coming out, plus some rain starting to fall in some key areas of Australia, what's likely to happen to the cattle price?
continue to move higher, Matt. So particularly in southern Australia, where we've had such a depletion of the herd. And so my expectation is with these good rains that we'll start to see some extraordinarily good prices going into the new year. And I think it really carries through most of next year as global beef supply continues to tighten. Brazil is expecting to go into their own rebuild, the US, southern Australia for sure. Matt, USDA is forecasting 400,000 tonnes less beef exported globally next year. That's a third of what we produce in Australia. So, Matt, the signs are good.
Simon Quilty from Global Agri Trends speaking to Matt Brann. And back home, WA Farmers Livestock Section President Jeff Pearson says while the lifting of tariffs is certainly welcome, the disruption over the recent months has actually pushed Australia's beef industry to explore new opportunities in other markets.
It's been concerning that the tariffs have been in limbo for some time, and Australia has got off reasonably lightly for that with one of the lower tariffs. But the beef industry is in good stead at the moment. US product is going out regularly from Australia. It's one of our biggest markets, and we haven't really seen much of a hiccup in the supply of beef, Australian beef, into the US due to the fact that there's been a big demand.
What other impacts might it have had on the industry?
It's obviously opened up a lot of other markets as well. While that disruption's been in place, it's actually opened up a few doors for Australian product to go into other markets. While the US has been uneasy, Australia's been with the US for some time, and we appreciate the trading relationship we've had with the US and the volume that's gone in there over the years. But it's also given us an opportunity to not put all eggs in one basket, so to speak, and look at other opportunities in other world markets. The tariffs, it was a bit confusing, the fact that Trump would be taxing their own people. We're seeing that in the cost of living, not only in Australia and the price of red meat, but the price of red meat and grinding beef and burger meat in the US as well, which is a big part of their population consumption. And that's hurting their own people, and that's obviously concerning to the everyday American consumer, and it's also concerning to Trump about making these decisions. So it can only help by the cost of living, not only in Australia but in America as well.
WA Farmers Livestock President Jeff Pearson speaking to Lauren Smith. There were almost 1,500 head of cattle sold at Mouchet this morning. Terry Birkin's been keeping an eye on the sale. Hello, Terry. Can you please run me through the details?
Numbers fell away this week, and although all categories eased in supply, it was mostly due to a lighter volume of bulls and heifers. The sale consisted of a high percentage of quality Angus and locally bred Droughtmaster cattle represented across most categories. Presented in the yarding were good lines of trade weight steers and heifers and large drafts of cows to suit all markets, along with well-bred yearlings and weaners. Feeder cows were in high demand, lifting 40 to 50 cents in value, and live shipping was strong on bull steers and heifers. Local weaner steers in plain condition sold from 200 cents to 380 cents and with more cover realised 480 cents a kilo. Light local weaner heifers were making 180 to 334 cents and better conditioned heifers from 380 to 410 cents a kilo. Yearling steers overall weight ranges were selling well, making 378 to 450 cents, and yearling heifers from 328 to 400 cents a kilo. Pastoral steer calves were light in number, ranging from 120 to 324 cents, while pastoral heifers were selling from 150 to 328 cents a kilo. Grown steers ranged from 338 to 408 cents, while grown heifers returned 298 to 390 cents a kilo. Light frame pastoral store cows sold from 60 cents to 236 cents, while bigger frame store cows are in demand, making 250 to 308 cents, while medium weight and heavy weights return 280 to 338 cents a kilo. Bulls suited for shipping are in demand from several exporters, selling from 250 cents to 412 cents, and heavy bulls gained another 10 cents, ranging from 250 to 340 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Terry. And the exact figures today were 1,476, including 93 calves, which was actually down by 780 on last week. Richard Hudson joins me in the studio once again.
Yeah, the bushfire watch and act has just been called by DFAS, the Department of Fire and Emergency Services. So this is in the Shire of Gingin. It's for anyone in the area and parts of Beermulla and Moore River National Park. So a bushfire watch and act is now in place for people in the area between Red Gully Road to the north and Douglas Road to the south. So there is a possible threat to lives and homes in that area as that fire is burning and it's obviously out of control. Conditions are changing. It sounds like DFAS might be a little bit worried about the winds because the bushfire is moving fast in a northerly direction. For more details on that, just search emergency in WA and that bushfire watch and act warning is at the very top, and also just keep listening to ABC local radio if you're in that area. If you're from that area but you're not there at the moment, just tune into ABC Midwest. And also just incidentally, just after one on the World Today, fire preparedness is going to be covered to do with disaster ready funds.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.